The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the meeting to order. And we'll start with the introduction, and we'll start with Mr. Ramey.
Gary Ramey, MLA, Lunenburg West.
Good morning. Matt Wynott, MLA, Hammonds Plains Upper.
Brian Skobar, member for Cumberland North.
Good morning. Clary McKinnon, MLA, Pictou East.
Good morning. Becky Kent, MLA for Cole Harbour Eastern Passage, and I'm here on behalf of Howard Epstein.
Morning, Kelly Regan, MLA, Bedford Bridge Cove, here on behalf of Manning McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alan McMaster from Inverness.
It's not on. Oh, there we go. Evangeline Coleman, SAD Assistant Auditor General.
Darlene Henry, Committee Clerk.
Good morning. I'm Kathy McNeil, Vice President of People at Capitol Health.
Good morning, I'm Chris Power, President and CEO of Capitol Health.
Good morning, Amanda Whitewood, Vice President, Sustainability and Chief Financial Officer, Capitol Health.
Vicki Sullivan, Director at the VG site, Cancer Care Transplant and Inpatient Units.
Thank you very much. I'd like to welcome our guests here this morning, and we're anxiously awaiting your comments to start the meeting off, I'd like to and invite you to give your opening comments before we start questioning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the members for inviting us here today. We know everyone is very conscious of the cost of providing health care services. Labor costs account for the greatest portion of health spending by far. At Capitol Health, we have a very skilled and dedicated workforce, including nurses, as well as physiotherapists, occupational therapists, personal care workers, social workers, lab technologists, and many others providing high-quality care to the people in this community and, through our specialty services, to people right across the province and the Atlantic region. Providing health care is a complex business, both in terms of the needs of the patients we serve and in terms of the coordination required to have the right group of people with the right mix of skills to meet the demand for care at any given time. We look to historic patterns of use when planning our services and staffing levels, but the day-to-day range in demand, how many people will require emergency care, surgery, or hospital admission at any particular time, is really wide. Similarly, there are patterns in sick time use among our staff, but it is difficult to plan ahead for illnesses that keep nurses and others from their scheduled shifts. We depend on the ability to have our specialized employees be able to work overtime hours as required, based on surges in patient needs or staff shortages due to illness. And we want to thank those dedicated staff who are flexible enough in their lives to respond to our needs as an employer, and most importantly, to the needs of our patients by working additional shifts when we have no other alternatives. We know this is a costly way to meet needs, and we are having success in reducing the use of overtime. Over the last 3 years, both our use of overtime hours and the amount we have spent on overtime have been reduced by approximately 30%. While we intend to continue to reduce the use of overtime hours, future financial savings will not be as large. Overtime costs are tied to wages, which are increasing every year. This year, about 71% of our nursing staff will work some overtime. Of those working overtime, two-thirds work fewer than 25 hours of overtime during the year. The projected cost of nursing overtime for 2012 is about $6.5 million. There are three key ways we're working to contain and reduce our dependence on overtime. These are consistent scheduling practices, use of information technology for better real-time data to improve management decision-making, and looking at different staffing models, such as the creation of a nursing resource team or specialized nursing staff available to be deployed as needed. To compare Capital Health to other jurisdictions, we can look at the percentage of all hours worked that are overtime hours. As of February 2012, the rate at Capital Health was 1.3%. The most recent national benchmark is 2% from 2011. As we continue to carefully manage our staffing and take advantage of technology, we expect to see some further reductions of overtime use, although, as we have noted, the ability to reduce costs is leveling off as basic wages increase. At Capital Health, we provide services through 9 hospitals as well as dozens of community-based locations across the region. We serve the 400,000 residents of Halifax Region and West Hants and provide specialist services to the rest of Nova Scotia and Atlantic Canada. We support care across Nova Scotia, so have a key role in responding to crises around the province and caring for the most seriously ill wherever they may live. As an example, our multi-organ transplant program serves all of Atlantic Canada. The opportunity to retrieve organs from donors can't be predicted, and it can't be passed up, although it pulls on the resources of the whole hospital system. Demand for our services is growing. It's insatiable. In the fiscal year that ended in March, we performed 400 more surgeries than the year before, or 1,000 more than we performed 2 years previous. Visits to the QE2 emergency department, as an example, reached an all-time high last summer and have been up year over year for several years. While overall demand continues to climb steadily, day-to-day volumes can't be predicted. We need to staff based on typical demand rather than the worst-case scenario, but maintain the flexibility to respond when there are surges in volume or the seriousness of patients' illnesses. It's a matter of being efficient with our resources while providing quality, safe care. Our present workforce includes just under 3,500 registered nurses and licensed practical nurses. It's important to note that because of the level of specialized care we provide, we are not able to deploy any nurse to any vacant shift. We have an experienced and skilled workforce. When, for instance, we need to fill a shift in an intensive care unit, we would need to fill the shift with a nurse with the high skill level required to work in that setting. These are specialty positions, mainly filled with senior staff at the top of the pay scale. Our operating budget to meet increasing demand is not growing. To accommodate cost pressures due to wage increases and inflation, we are working on operational changes that would save about $15 million in the current fiscal year. Due to these constraints, our ability to hire new nurses has been limited. We have been eliminating vacant positions, including nursing positions, over the last 2 years due to fiscal constraints, so fewer jobs have been available to new graduates. To be most efficient, we want to have registered nurses doing the work that only they can do and not diverted to tasks that could be accomplished by others on the healthcare team. Throughout Capital Health, wherever possible, we are looking at what providers are best able to perform certain aspects of care according to the settings where they work and the range of skills of their professions. Care teams organize tasks as a collective among registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, and care team assistants to best meet patient needs rather than be confined by their traditional position descriptions. That's an industrious approach stemming from the best of intentions. What we'd rather see, and the direction that we are taking with the work that we're doing, would be having the right mix of people in each work setting to working to their full appropriate capacity so that nurses can provide leadership to the team and trust their colleagues are in place to address other needs that patients and families may identify. Quality and patient safety are ensured by having the most appropriate care provider perform the most appropriate tasks to commit to the safest care possible. Scheduling staff throughout our hospitals has largely been done with pen and paper until now, a cumbersome and time-consuming process repeated unit by unit across our hospitals. However, with support from the Department of Health and Wellness Change and Innovation Fund, we are putting into place software called Kronos that helps to schedule working hours accurately and ensures consistent implementation across units. Improved staff scheduling flexibility and control ensures that individuals with the right skills are in the right place to meet critical needs. This software will help with planning and forecasting staffing needs. The data analysis tools and real-time reports will allow us to respond quickly to human resource and labor situations and even help avoid them through advanced human resource planning. Another new province-wide information technology application supported by that innovation fund is the Bed Utilization Management Program. We know it as BUMP, planned to be operational province-wide by the end of this year. This will help give a better picture of how beds are used throughout the healthcare system. This software will assist in identifying when and where beds are ready or becoming available and provide better insight into the factors showing the flow of patients through the system. Information like this will assist us in using resources more efficiently and planning our staffing more effectively. We need to acknowledge unit managers and charge nurses for their significant roles in the overtime reductions we've already seen. Their careful oversight and work to match staff resources to patient needs has been critical as we strive to maintain a high standard of care while balancing the pressures of volume and finances. I want to thank them for their work. Filling a shift using staff as overtime is a last resort. Before taking that step, a charge nurse or unit manager would consider the patients in the unit at the time and whether the staffing complement can safely meet their needs. Other options that would be pursued before bringing in staff on overtime include shifting staff already working in other areas to cover a shortage, or bringing in part-time or casual employees, or staff of third-party agencies. While our overtime use has been dropping, our use of third-party services has stayed relatively consistent over the last 3 years, projected to be about $2.6 million for fiscal 2012. There are also other circumstances that can result in staff being paid overtime according to the terms of their collective agreements, such as a change in schedule with little notice. Again, with better tools and information to assist with scheduling, we hope we are better able to avoid instances like these in the future as well. Once again, I thank members of the committee for their interest in this subject. Controlling overtime costs has been an area of focus for us and one we've had significant success in addressing. With our expanding access to new and better information technology tools, we hope to continue this success. And now we'd be happy to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll start the questioning, Ms. Regan, and you have 20 minutes to start.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming in today to join us to speak to this particular issue. I'm wondering if Capital Health District has ever done a nursing resource plan so that we would calculate how many nurses are actually needed for the area, for this area?
Sure. I'll ask Kathy to address that.
Ms. McNeil.
Thank you for the question. We at Capital Health participate in the province-wide resource planning for nursing resources, looking at kind of what the whole system needs. As Chris mentioned in the opening comments, we do provide specialized services at Capital Health that may be unique compared to other areas in the province. But we also understand that when any needs we have at Capital Health also impacts the rest of the system. So we feel our planning needs to be done as a system, and we participate with the other members of the system, also with our colleagues at Department of Health and Wellness, to look at our projected needs going forward for nursing resources, both RNs and LPNs.
So I would take from that there has been one there has not been one done specifically for Capital Health. There's been a province-wide one done, but not.
That's correct. We did do some projection work for Capital Health about 3 years back. One of the things that we're finding as we do some of this planning work for health human resources is it's predicated on some assumptions that may or may not play out to be true. One of those assumptions is looking at the average retirement age, and what we're noticing is people are retiring later or not retiring at all, and with that assumption it throws off some of those projected numbers that we have been doing. So we have not done those projections within the last 3 years. We've been participating more in the system-wide work that's been happening.
So how many nursing positions are currently vacant for which you're actively recruiting right now?
Today, we have about 47 positions that are vacant at Capital Health. For the most part, those are for registered nurses. We have, another about 17 for licensed practical nurses. For the most part, those registered nursing positions are in what we would call our special care areas. So those are areas or units that have specialty skills that are required. Emergency department, intensive care units, intermediate care units, ORs. So we will often find that we have vacancies in some of those areas. Those also happen to be some of the areas where we experience overtime.
I think it was yesterday on Career Beacon, There was a notice for applications pooling registered nurses for ORs at Capital Health, and it said we are pooling applicants for possible future vacancies in our operating rooms. Is that standard practice? Is that something new? We haven't noticed it before?
We have been doing some work in our operating rooms in terms of efficiencies, working to work more efficiently and effectively with the resources we have. I suspect we often have what we would call standing postings. I suspect that particular posting for the ORs would be in conjunction with the work we're doing around our efficiency redesign work.
And similar, there is a posting for applicants for possible future vacancies in our emergency department. So is it the same kind of thing?
Yes. So because we know these areas have specialized skill needs, we will often proactively keep a posting in place so that we don't have a lag time when we do have people who choose to leave, or also maternity leaves. 81% of our population at Capital Health are female, and so we do see a lot of movement with maternity leaves and our age demographic.
So earlier when Ms. Power was speaking, she talked about to accommodate cost pressures due to wage increases and inflation, we are working on operational changes that would save about $15 million in the current year. So is this part of that, to try and get a handle on what you have available, or is this is just simply being ready when people leave?
The proactive nature of the postings would be something that we've tried to do as part of common practice, our business practice. The reduction in, or the efficient use of our human resources and some of the work we're doing around overtime reduction is part of that, the $15 million business planning target that we have this year. Part of the work that we've alluded to that, Chris alluded to it in the opening comments, is working with some technology to implement for staff scheduling so that we have some real-time data. We can have a better view of what we're where staff are working, when, what overtime is being accrued within in a real-time way, so we can make better decisions around staff allocation.
Now, according to the information that was provided, the total complement of nursing staff is decreasing, is less than in fiscal 2012 than in 2011. Is that because of the cost pressures, the wage increases, and the need to absorb various increases in other costs?
So there's a number of factors that would go into those numbers. First of all, we did implement some changes in our business plan last year, and in order to minimize the impact of layoffs or staff reductions, we eliminated some vacant positions as a first pass. So some of those vacant positions would have been registered nurses and licensed practical nurse positions. Some other changes we made as part of that business planning process was the reduction of some inpatient bed capacity, and there were some nursing positions attached to those inpatient beds as well that would have been reduced. The third, I think, factor that's impacting, I guess, the total complement numbers that you're seeing would be the work we're doing around models of care. And some of the innovating some models of care would be looking at the type of care provider that, or the way teams are configured with the care providers and the skill mix that are available to best meet patient needs. So an example of what that might look like is in a unit that may have been predominantly staffed with registered nurses, we would look to see what's the patient population need and bring in other kinds of care providers, including licensed practical nurses or care team assistants, to round out that skill mix in that care team. So from a complement perspective, you may see fewer registered nurses, but we may have actually added the licensed practical nurses or the care team assistant role. I know last year we did add a number of care team assistants to the skill mix at Capital Health through the models of care work.
So I'm assuming this is having a fair impact on graduating nurses coming out. How many new nurses did you hire last year? Do you know? Graduating nurses, I guess. Yeah.
Last year, we hired, I think it was 20 graduate nurses. They were not in permanent full-time positions. For the most part, they were hired into casual roles because exactly the reason that you've pointed out, our complement had changed. That's one of the kind of innovations we're looking at this year, is how can we create some capacity to hire some new graduate nurses, knowing that there are special skill needs that as a new graduate they'd need to acquire before they'd be able to be deployed to all areas at Capital Health. But we're looking at a concept that University Health Network in Toronto has worked on, called a nursing resource team, where we would have a cohort of nurses, some of whom would be new graduates, some of whom would be skilled nurses, who would work as a team but be available to be deployed out to units based on their skill level. And we see this as an approach to be able to hire some new graduates, keep them in the province, give them some skills, and also work as an alternative to using other casuals and overtime and the third-party agencies.
That 20 number, how does that compare to previous years?
The year before, I believe, and I could be wrong, but I believe the year before we hired 80 new graduates.
80?
80, yes.
So we're talking a quarter of what we used to hire?
Yes.
So you must have heard from a lot of graduate nurses who are a little shocked that they've graduated and there's no place for them to work?
Yes, I think all of us are feeling that we are. This is not the situation we want for our new graduates to find themselves, nor us as a system. But as I said before, there are a number of factors that play into that, and not the least of which is the fact that we have many people who are choosing to stay later in their career with us, and who are also choosing to come back in casual capacities after they've retired. So what happens is the positions just are not there, and we don't feel it's responsible to make a commitment to people unless we can provide them with that work and the skill, the training and education that goes along with that.
Can you give me a figure, how many nurses actually work to age 65?
I don't have that number with us. We do, on the package we circulated, we did give you some information around minimum and maximum ages, though.
Yeah.
And you'll see in that there are a number of nurses who are working beyond 65. Just trying to find the page. Page 10 and page 11 kind of speak to the employee age. But you'll see on page 11, maximum age for active employees in nursing. In terms of regular full-time, we have the maximum ages are up to be about 68. Part-time up around maximum age. Now, this is not average, but these would be individuals who would be in the system at the end of their career. So these are people, if you look at regular, full-time, and part-time, these are people who have not exercised their right to retire. Mm-hmm. So they're working beyond the retirement age.
And I'm assuming that if changes to OAS are implemented, we may, in fact, see people working more people working longer, which will make it more difficult to get new grads in because people won't be retiring.
I won't speculate on that. I know I'll be in that group myself.
I didn't think you would. Yeah, so sort of the age 54 folks and down, I think, are looking at that quite closely. In terms of surgery cancellation rates, both resource-related and patient-related cancellations are decreasing. Have there been any instances recently where the unavailable of human resources, for example, a nurse, would result in a surgery cancellation? I'm thinking of, you know, a case in my own riding where a woman I know who had been waiting quite a while for surgery for gastrointestinal problems. Excuse me, you know, was literally prepped and being rolled down the hall, and her surgery was canceled because one of the surgical team had not shown up.
Ms. Bauer?
We track all canceled surgeries, so I don't have information about a particular case would know that, but we certainly track and report on that on a monthly basis, exactly why patients were canceled. It would be unusual that we cancel patients because a surgical team member hadn't shown up, unless it was the surgeon, but that would be an unusual situation for us.
So it doesn't happen very often?
Not that I'm aware of. We can certainly track back and look at that, but I wouldn't suspect that that's a reason why surgeries are canceled, because we don't have a nurse to be in the room or a technical person. We usually, the team are amazing at making that happen.
It was one of the surgeons.
Okay.
According to the overview section of the document entitled Nursing Overtime Cost Hourly Rate Analysis, one of the challenges noted are the specialty skills required of certain nurses, making it impossible to avoid overtime. Just you need the appropriate bodies in the appropriate places. Is there any particular specialty or unit where the occurrence of overtime is more frequent than any other? And if so, which one, and what would be the reasons for that?
Ms. McNeil?
Our two examples of where we know we experience higher levels of overtime would be our emergency departments at the QE2 and at Dartmouth General. I think there are a number of factors at play there. One is the unpredictable nature of the volume of patients that are seen come through the doors at any given time. I think there's also stresses in our emergency department that are created by the number of patients who may have to wait there for extended lengths of time to be able to be placed in inpatient beds elsewhere in the hospitals. And so that presents some stresses, I would say, to the nursing staff in the emergency department who need to provide care to those patients as they await bed placement. The other complicating factor, as you pointed to, is the level of technology and the level of skills that are required to work in the emergency department with the information technology systems, the equipment. It's not an area that a new graduate, for example, could be placed in easily to find their way and work safely and effectively. So there are a number of factors there that create some pressures in our emergency departments in particular.
It was probably contained in here, but I didn't note it. The earlier we were talking about the minimizing the impact of layoffs, and there were a number of things that were done to do that, and one of them was to close some beds. Can you tell me how many beds were closed in Capital Health to minimize that?
I'll start this one, and I may ask Vicky, actually, because Vicky has led many of the initiatives for our business plan. Last year, so it would have been fiscal 11-12, we closed, or actually redistributed patients, it's the best way to describe how we did it, from one unit at the VG site, I believe it was 9B. And those patients were situated or placed elsewhere in the organization. So one unit was closed. So the employees that moved, that worked on 9B were actually moved to other areas of the facility as well. And I don't have an exact number of beds at the end of it that ended up being closed, but I would, I think Vicky may have that information.
Last October we closed 9B at the VG site. 9B, for a variety of reasons, was closed because it's a old facility with a lot of issues, particularly around heat. And the patients that were being cared for in that particular area were general surgery patients, who are extremely heavy patients. And for both staff and patients, a decision was made to close that particular unit. There were 26 general surgery beds, of which those 26 general surgery beds have actually been redistributed at the VG site. And what we've done is, so for example, on one of our inpatient units, 3B, we had closed beds, and those beds were being used as offices. They were actually turned back into beds. So what we did was we maximized the capacity on other units that physically and certainly from an air control perspective were a lot more suitable for patient care and staffs. So they've been all redistributed.
Ms. Power?
Just to add to that, our long-term strategy is to vacate the Victoria General Hospital, as I'm sure you are aware. And so as part of our strategy, we continue to look at how we can move patients out of that unsatisfactory and sometimes unsafe environment into a better one. And so that was all part of the work that we were doing.
So I just want to be clear when... we were talking about minimizing the impact of layoffs, the reduction of inpatient bed capacity. In fact, that did that result in layoffs among nurses, or were they redistributed among other units?
Ms. McNeil?
So you're right. They, for the most part, were redistributed among other units. What that would have done is filled other vacancies that might have been created in other units. So those positions would not have been available to be posted and filled by new hires.
Thank you for clarifying that for me. The overview outlines that the report produced breaks down a number of hours that were paid at overtime rates as opposed to the total dollar amount paid out in compensation for the overtime hours worked. Despite the challenges associated with the comparisons, any idea how much was...
Order. Order, please. Unfortunately, Ms. Regan, your time has expired. Mr. D'Entremont.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to spend a few moments. Thank the folks of Capital Health for being here today. Ms. Power, always good to see you. I apologize for being a little late, and I missed sort of the beginning of your presentation. I did have a quick look at it as I was waiting. I was meeting with some physician assistant people, another interesting allied health professional that we might be able to have here in Nova Scotia. But let's talk about the issue at hand, and I am going to talk about the nurses' overtime issue as laid out. But I'd also like to talk a little bit, maybe a little bit, about the negotiation that we just finished up, or at least is still ongoing with Local 42. If that's okay with you, for just a few moments, just to, because I know they sort of go together a little bit, because we are going to be talking about increased costs for staffing within the district. My first question is 76%, and this is what I had to report, the RN staff working overtime are paid at the two highest rates of pay. 80% of LPN overtime goes to the highest pay grade of LPN. In the staff scheduling process, there are 8 steps to avoid a situation where overtime is needed. If it is necessary for overtime to occur, how come the highest paid are claiming the majority of the overtime shifts? And I think it goes a little bit to the ER answer, but I'll let you, I know it's a big question, so take some time.
Ms. McNeil.
Thank you for the question, and it's interesting, if we look at that graph in its own isolation, it does look like the people who are at the highest rates of pay are working the majority of overtime. The reason for that is that most of our, it takes 6 years to work through these pay grades for a registered nurse. Many of our staff, 76% of our nursing staff are in the last two pay grades. So between step six and the 25-year retention increment, that those are the last two that you see. So 76% of our employees are in those groups. That's why 71% of them are they're earning that overtime. This, in the licensed practical nurse pay grade, there are 4 steps. So it doesn't take long as a new graduate to get to the top of your salary scale, and hence that's why the predominant amount of overtime rate is accrued in those higher levels of pay.
Okay. What are the rules around consecutive hours a nurse can care for a patient during a 24-hour period or in a week? You know, we continually hear of nurses being called back and called back, but, you know, what is the safe limit of how many hours a week a nurse should be working?
For the most part, and again, unfortunately, I'm not a registered nurse, and I may ask my colleague registered nurses to answer this. For the most part, the College of Registered Nurses has position statements around fatigue management and the consecutive working of overtime. And it's my understanding that as a registered nurse, there's a shared accountability between the employer and myself in terms of kind of raising a flag when I feel that I may have worked too much, that I'm not safe, or I'm too tired or compromised in my care. That said, we do follow the provisions in the collective agreement around overtime shifts. We do rotate to the next most senior in offering those shifts as required for overtime. We comply with the Occupational Health and Safety Act with respect to overtime work. We are working right now on a fatigue management protocol that would look to have a little more clarity in terms of setting some guidelines where people can have some reference point in terms of measuring their fatigue and their capability to deliver safe and quality care.
Okay, because I also think that it's not only, you know, a situation for the nursing staff itself, but it's also, I think, a patient safety issue that, you know, you're getting jumbled up in your time, you're getting jumbled up in your in your patients and all the things that are going on. I know what happens to me when I don't sleep for 24 hours, and I know this continues to happen time and time again for different nurses and different allied health professionals in our system today. Nursing overtime in 2012 is still about $6.5 million compared to the purchase service cost of about $2.6 million. That's about 2.5 times more spent on overtime than regular hours. How are we going to adjust that? And I know you did attack that a little bit in your presentation, but how do we continue to squish that in? Because it's always an issue of how many full-time staff you have, how many part-time staff you have, and try to work it out that way. So where are we going with that to try to rein that one in?
There are a number of initiatives underway to look at that. I'll just for purpose of clarity, the purchase service amount that we quote here in the documents, that's a third-party agency support. But in terms of the overtime use or how we allocate overtime, there's a number of things that we have underway this year. The first one, I think, that we are quite excited by the potential for real-time information is the use of the staff scheduling technology. So that technology, we had established in January of 2011 what we call a nursing resource office. So centralizing scheduling for the QE2 site as a pilot. And what we're seeing is when we did that, we realized some efficiencies and some economies because we had some consistent interpretation of the collective agreement. We started to consistently apply the scheduling practices, and we had some payroll consistency in terms of how shifts were being coded. So there were some significant savings, and actually that was led under Vicki Sullivan's leadership. So in extending that, the next step, that office right now is using a Microsoft SharePoint site in order to share information so that managers across the 29 units that it supports can access the information in a timely way. That's almost a homegrown solution. What the technology that the Change and Innovation Fund has enabled is a best practice staff scheduling solution that's used in healthcare across the country and in other jurisdictions that will allow staff to be able to access their schedules online from home, make online requests to their manager for changes. So that will be some efficiencies for employees. It will allow managers to see real-time data, so patterns of use, patterns of peaks and valleys. It's going to be coupled with our workload management tool, so they'll work in combination and complementary. And as an organization, we'll have a better sense of how we're using the staff and how we can project, as Ms. Regan had asked, had suggested, to do better planning for health human resource needs. We have established a target for this year of around $600,000 to realize more savings in overtime costs with the use of that technology. We're hoping ourselves, Capital Health, IWK, and Cumberland Health Authority are all participating in this innovation fund, and we're anticipating that technology be implemented by the end of this fiscal year.
So the technology system, I mean, that we're using today, I mean, I go back to my time of talking about PeopleSoft and talking about all the other programs that we had across the system that wasn't making any sense to anybody for the most part. So the question is will it be apt for abuse, you know, in a way that, I need a couple extra shifts, would you mind giving me a couple extra shifts and you call in sick and do all that kind of stuff? Or is there, are we going to be able to track it correctly? I mean, what kind of snapshots is it going to be giving us? Because there's a whole bunch of things that you can do to a system that might not give you the data that you need.
So I think you're pointing to some anecdotal kind of stories that, I call it them legends that happen around, people tell around overtime, and that gets coupled with sick time. So in full transparency, people do kind of create these things and phenomena that are happening. We don't have evidence right now to say that is in fact true. What we do know is we need to collect better information about our how we schedule staff, how they're used when they're there, and what the patterns are of that use so that we can make better management decisions around that. And we can create policy and we can, work with our employees accordingly. So I think you're pointing to the fact that we'll have a system, we'll have information. The third step of this is we're going to have to use it for decision making, and we have every intention of doing that.
Okay. Thank you. thank you. I'll move to, I know I already got 10 minutes gone. That doesn't take long to ask some questions for 20 minutes. So I'm going to maybe go to Chris and whoever else wants to answer it. During the recent negotiations, there was a fairly substantial increase in pay for the Capital Health workers. And some of them, of course, are nurses and other professionals. What is that cost going to be, and how is the board going to be able to deal with that increase?
So we don't have the results of that arbitration yet. So we've got a range, and we'd speculate. But I'll ask Amanda perhaps to speak to that as our CFO.
Ms. Whitewood.
We do have
the cost pressure of the base of 1% included in our business plan and associated mitigations to deal with that. Over and above that, we don't have a mitigation plan for that. And as you might expect, we are having conversations with our colleagues at the Department of Health and Wellness in terms of how we go forward as a system, as a collective together.
I know you're talking to the department, but is the department necessarily pushing back a little bit, or are they playing the wait and see, we'll see where the arbitration actually goes and we'll make a decision after that, or are they actually getting you to start doing some mitigation already on your budgets and getting you to cut things back already?
We do have an approved business plan, as you know, so we are actively involved in pursuing all of those savings that have been identified and approved. If we were to go deeper than those items that have been approved, I suspect we would need a formal process to do that, and at this point, we haven't been engaged in those dialogues.
Okay. If you didn't have the essential services agreement in place, how bad would have the how many surgeries and procedures would have been canceled throughout? We hear the numbers that because of the possible impending strike that we did have to roll back a whole bunch of services for that time being. But of course, that is matching up to the current agreement on essential service. Where could we have gotten had that gone a little further?
Ms. Power.
So I'll start this, and any of my colleagues may want to join in. When we have to go into planning mode for a strike, even if a strike doesn't happen, we there's a huge impact on our patients and on our staff, and this time was no exception. So the agreement that we had with NSGEU was for a very limited number of staff for emergency types of services. So that really was for life and limb for our patients. So as you would have read in the paper, a significant number, hundreds into the thousands of patients were affected, and every single day that was the case. So had we gone into a full strike, we were in effect, our staff weren't out on strike, but we were acting as if we were because we had to. We're a big organization to pull down. Every day would have been that number multiplied by each day that we were out. So significant impact.
How many, from the nursing standpoint itself, how do you staff, as you started to roll things down, how many staff were being shut down and how many people were being worked out? How many staff did it impact as it rolled around?
Vicki, do you want to?
Ms. Sullivan.
Sullivan, there you go.
Thank you. In terms of our planning, what we did have to do is at the HI site, we actually closed one of our orthopedic units, and the staff from that particular unit, the nursing staff, were redistributed to other inpatient units at the HI site. And at the VG site, we actually closed two units. We closed 9A, which is a 30-bed unit, and we closed 3B, which was a 25-bed unit. And that was to consolidate staff on the other units to make sure that we had a safe level of staffing to actually provide for the patients who actually required our care.
In that process, and I'm just trying to think back to the time that I was involved in this one. You know, how much work? I mean, I know ASGU was, of course, probably a part of it at the table, trying to help you figure some of these things out of where you were going. How was the relationship throughout those negotiations? Did the negotiations go as you had planned?
Ms. McNeil. Ms. McNeil, a little bit of trouble with our mics here.
Keep going. There you go.
There we go. We got it now.
So I'm assuming you're asking the questions around the emergency service levels. Yes.
Yeah.
So we're fortunate that we have that provision in our collective agreement with NSGEU for nursing and for Local 42 to negotiate the levels that we need for maintenance of life and limb for emergency services. And I would say that we had some good cooperation in negotiating that. We did have an arbitrator help us in some sticky areas where we needed to have some help coming to the numbers that were required. All in general, we had, if you roll everything to a cumulative number, we had about 27% of our normal staffing levels were approved through the emergency staffing levels.
So now we are a few weeks beyond that. How have things got back to normal? How are they feeling? Is everything sort of back to normal, or are we still sort of seeing a little bit of that repercussion of canceled surgeries and things?
Ms. Power?
So it doesn't take us long to get back to normal, and the next day we were ramping up, and by Monday of that week we were full steam ahead. My understanding is all of the patients who were... had their surgery postponed or their clinics canceled or postponed in this process have all been rebooked. Most of the surgeries have been completed, and those that haven't, those patients know when they're coming, and it will be soon. So we are back to as normal as we ever get.
Thank you. Going back to nursing, and one that I enjoyed working on with the District Health Authorities, which was the nursing model of care. Just wondering, how many units do you have using the new model of care, and you know, what are the learned information from those now? I've heard different reports from it, whether some of them have worked, some of them haven't, depending on who you are within that team, whether it works or not for you. Maybe just some overarching issues on model of care.
Okay, so I'll start. Maybe Vicky might have some comments to add. We have had 100% of our units have been engaged in the model of care work over this time throughout Capital Health. Have all of them been a success? We've had varying degrees of success, and we've had varying degrees of implementation. It remains a work in progress. We are a huge organization, and we continue to have this as a priority for our organization. As Kathy mentioned, we've had a lot of changes in our staffing mix in many of our areas, and they are working well. Change is difficult. We have been in, you know, a way of doing business for a long time in the healthcare world with just some incremental changes in some of our areas. So this takes a lot of work and a lot of continued work. So it doesn't happen and then you walk away. This is continual. So I would say it's been a success story for us. It certainly was well worth the investment we put in. It's a tremendous investment because it's about change, and it's about changing the way people work and think, but we still have a long way to go in order to be where we want to be at the end of the day.
Ms. Sullivan?
Oh, yeah, please.
Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, just in terms of, I mean, the work we've done has been primarily in the inpatient areas. I think, as Chris had indicated, we have some experience now, years of experience, and are re-looking at the mix that we've put there. Some of that's been driven by the changes in the patient population. Some of it's driven by whether or not we got it right the first time, and whether or not we need to revisit the mix of staff we have on that particular unit. Where we still have work to do is in our ambulatory areas, and in many of our areas now, we are currently embarking on looking at who are the right care providers to actually have around our patients in our different ambulatory areas.
Thank you very much, because it's always good to hear of, you know, projects that have started some time ago now to see where they are actually rolling out and, you know, what kind of success we've been seeing in them. I see my time is getting close to an end. I just want to again thank you for being here. I unfortunately got double booked today, so I'm going to have to fly off to my next meeting, but I will leave you with my able colleague, Mr. McMaster, for the second round of questioning. But again, just to thank you so much for being here today.
Order, please. Your time has expired. Mr. Ramey.
Thank you very much, and I've been listening with interest to what you've been saying, and the word change it does keep coming up. I wonder if I'll say something, and you tell me if I'm characterizing it correctly. What I think I've been hearing is that there's everything occurs in context, and we hear daily on the news, as recent as yesterday, yet again, about countries and jurisdictions and states that are in fiscal trouble because they're not managing their finances wisely, or they refuse to bite the bullet and do what they need to do. So would I characterize correctly some of the challenges that you're facing as trying to work within a reasonable fiscal envelope, having staff that continue to work for longer than perhaps they used to, and the unpredictability of the nature of the work that you're involved in as being three critical factors that have to be considered in trying to get things to work properly? And am I correct in that? And if there are others, feel free to add what they are, too.
Well, I'd say you're correct in characterizing that those are certainly factors that are influencing the work that we're doing. What we are here to do is care for the people who need us. And we want to be sure that our community and our citizens know that we'll be there for them. What we are trying hard to do is to work with our community to share that accountability around health and wellness. So although we talk about an insatiable demand and the unpredictability of people who continue to come and need our services, and we need to be there for them, part of the work that we're doing, and we often just go to the in-hospital, the sickest patients, because that's where we spend the most of our money in our time, but we are really trying to change the face of healthcare at Capital Health. So a lot of the work that we're doing is to try to keep you and us healthy so you won't need those services. So yes, we are in a very unpredictable times. We have a high disease burden in this province. We have an insatiable demand on our service. We have a great fiscal record over the last 6 or 7 years of meeting our budget targets and coming in on budget and providing the care that our patients need. But it is a juggling act, and it is always a work in progress, and we are always driving that change that you mentioned to work to best practice and to be the best we can be.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, I think the best health care plan is one where you don't go to the hospital in the first place, and you've just addressed that, and you're absolutely right. And I don't envy the task you have. I mean, I think you're doing a remarkable job, given the confines that you have to work in. When did you start looking at reducing the amount of overtime that nurses work? When did that examination take place? How long ago?
So this has been an age-old challenge for us. I'll let Kathy talk more specifically to the last few years that we've been really addressing it, but we've been looking at sick time and overtime because there is a related relationship between them mm-hmm. for a number of years. But Kathy, maybe you want to speak to
Ms.
our
McNeil.
Specific areas.
I think that we saw opportunities to do things quite differently following our H1N1 experience. So 2009, 2010 were, I think, the years that we shifted. And we made some changes, and one of those big changes was looking at the Nursing Resource Office as a concept, so centralizing some decision-making, centralizing some how overtime is allocated and the process. Although there are many steps, actually there's multiple off-ramps in those many steps that could avoid overtime. So getting more rigor around that, I would say, since 2009-10. However, I don't want to leave the impression that this has not been an opportunity that we in the system have not not seen and worked on over many years. I think what we understand and what we see in our staffing and with health human resource planning is we have waves. So we have waves of time where we have many people, a few jobs. Then we have waves of time where there's few people and many jobs. Mm-hmm. So we have to continue to do that dance of recruitment and efficiency management all at the same time. I would say this past round has been those last 2 years, and I think the numbers we put in the package shows some real success in managing the overtime costs over those last 2 to 3 years.
Was I correct when I was looking at the information that in terms of overtime we're a bit below the national average? We're 1.3 and it's the national average is 2. Am I correct on that?
Yes, we participate in a national benchmarking exercise. It's called HRBN. There are 70 organizations across the country that participate. About 50 of them are healthcare. So the national average is, as they express overtime as a percentage of total wage costs, their benchmark is 2%. We're, as of February this year, we're at 1.3%. So we're significantly underneath the national benchmark. And I think that is in no small part due to some of these changes that we've been making.
So do you have, or maybe you don't want to talk too much about this, I don't know, but do you have a goal that you're trying to get to? Do you have a benchmark in your minds here in Nova Scotia that you're trying to reach, or are you just quite satisfied in making sure that you're below the Canadian average at this point in time?
I think we'll ask Amanda to speak to that one.
Ms. Whitewood.
Thank you. As we've been saying this morning, we have been successful in reducing not only the hours of overtime, but the actual cost of overtime by approximately 30% over the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. Our milestone that was included in our three-year business plan, our target, was 10%. Reduction.
Really?
So it's not often that a system of care such as ourselves get a point to celebrate like this. It's a huge point of change and success for us. Having said that, we have a target of approximately $640,000 for this fiscal year, mostly attributed to the new scheduling system that's been mentioned to further reduce overtime. And I think it's fair to note that the dramatic change that we've seen, because we are outperforming the benchmark right now, the dramatic shift that we've seen of 30% over the last 3 years will not continue. That was based on 1% wage increments, and as we see wages go up,
yeah.
Even if we do have a further reduction of a small amount of hours going down, we really don't expect this type of quantum to repeat itself going forward.
Okay, and you touched on something there when you were answering that question that I continue to be interested in. It's been referenced a couple of times, maybe by my colleagues as well, but you talked about the staffing project that's in process that will track the hours of employees and so on. Is it Kronos? Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Yeah, so can you just tell us when that started, when that project started? It came from, and how long ago, and where, what the status of it is right now, what part you're at right now?
Ms. Sullivan?
Okay, the staff scheduling project actually began in right after H1N1, so December of 2010. I think our experience then told us that we had an opportunity to do things differently and to look at consistent practices across the organization. That actually was an approved business initiative at Capital Health, and then we had an opportunity to partner with our other colleagues in Nova Scotia, our two other districts, IWK and Cumberland, to actually look at a staffing solution, which is electronic. I think it's important to reiterate, an electronic scheduling system alone will not produce the results. You need some changes in workforce planning, but also in terms of scheduling practices. And so what we've had the opportunity at Capital Health over the last year plus is to actually do those changes and move towards a centralized approach. So the office has actually been functioning since January of 2011. And we have put in manual systems and processes, and that's when we've been using SharePoint. In the meantime, there had to be an RFP put out for the electronic solution, and Kronos is actually the successful vendor. We are doing the background work now in terms of getting the Kronos system, the system ready, with a plan for implementation late fall, early winter, in the three districts. But I think it's a combination of factors. What the electronic solution will actually provide us is with that real-time data. So as a manager, rather than waiting to get something out the back end in a six-month time frame, we have an ability to get reports on a daily basis, looking at who's coming to work, who's not, and what have you. So it's that real-time data that makes it a lot easier for managers to manage in a proactive fashion.
So when you say the three districts, which are you referring to?
The pilot with Kronos and with the staff scheduling project was a pilot that involved the three districts. So Capital Health, IWK, and Cumberland are the three early adopters. My understanding is that with a plan for future provincial rollout, but a lot of it was dependent on the pilot.
So are you telling me that eventually, if all things being equal and if things work out the way we hope they will, that there will eventually be a province-wide system where all the DHAs or whatever will feed information into this system and it'll track the staffing for the whole province? Am I correct in that?
I think Kathy is best to answer that. She's been the provincial lead.
Ms. McNeil?
So we have funding now to implement in those three organizations. There will be, though, the way we're configuring this system is with a view to eventually have the ability to use it across the whole province. Mm-hmm. We don't have funding to implement it across the province as we sit here today, and we need to make sure we get it in, we get it working, we make good decisions, we road test it and we prove that the investment was worth it, and then look to what the capacity is at the provincial level to apply it across all the district health authorities in the IWK.
So the pilot you're running with the IWK Capital and is it Cumberland
Health Authority?
That you'll get the glitches worked out and see if you can tweak it and do all that sort of thing, and then it would be ready possibly if funding's available to put it across the province. Now, in that system, this other program you have called BUMP, the bid utilization mechanism program, is that also tracked in this same system, or is that a separate thing?
It is a separate system. It's a system by the vendor MedWorks. That is a provincial-wide implementation that will look at acute care beds across all of the district health authorities in the IWK, and really will be a tool that we as a province can use for patient flow and can best help us make decisions around patient placement, returning patients to home hospitals, patients coming into Capital Health for care. We had a bit of a window into what a province-wide bed utilization process would look like when we implemented an ICU bed dashboard as part of our contingency planning work for the Local 42 negotiations. And we had great cooperation across the province from the district health authorities that had intensive care beds in their footprint. And we started the process around coordinating patient placement in ICU. So that was an early view into what that might look like when the whole system is implemented.
Well, fantastic. I mean, that makes total sense to me, too. If we know where the beds are and if they're occupied or not, that would seem to me to be very valuable. And getting away from a manual system, just the same way you would in any modern business. I mean, most people aren't writing out receipt books constantly and doing that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. My final question, because I'm going to run out of time and we may not even have time for you to answer it, but I'll throw it out there anyway. And you may not have this information with you today, but it's the Capital Health District is in a unique position, as I understand it, because we also look after folks from other provinces who have very severe issues and need to come here. How do the other provinces who use our capital health care system, which I'm very pleased that we offer up and everything, but how do they pay us, or what is the fiscal mechanisms in place for, let's say, people coming from PEI, Newfoundland, or New Brunswick who need to come to Capital District for major issues?
So I'll start, and Amanda can fill in any of the blanks. There is an interprovincial rate that is negotiated between all provinces. It really was put in place that to contemplate if, for instance, you were on vacation in Ontario, in Toronto, and you fell and broke your leg, that you could go and you'd have your service there and that'd be billed back and forth. The difference for us is that we are providing care routinely to Atlantic Canadians. So the rates aren't often reflective of what the actual cost is continually. Because of that, we have been working closely with Department of Health and Wellness, who has been looking at the interprovincial rates to be sure that we are recovering the costs. Mm-hmm. The costs for inpatient care provided to people outside of Nova Scotia comes back to the Department of Health and Wellness. It does not come into our budget, which is it causes some interesting issues for us, particularly around things like transplantation, where our numbers were a victim of our success. We're the best in the country in terms of organ donation now. We are seeing amazing success. It has huge costs, and we aren't, you know, gathering the getting back, I think, what it really costs us. We're seeing an effect of that. But there is a mechanism in place. And where we have outstanding issues, such as an example, internal defibrillators, we have relationships and special agreements with various provinces to pay to actually cover the cost of those devices. So, Matt, I don't know if there's anything you want to add that I haven't covered.
Perhaps just to note that as we look forward to more science in the way that we do our nursing staffing and so on, we also look forward to more science in our language around the costs of healthcare. Part of that is case costing and embarking on that initiative with the support of the Canadian Institute for Health Information. So right now we are with the most recent edition of IWK, two of the only sites east of Ontario as designated case costing sites. And you will, over the coming years, hear us talk about the full costs of cases. Patient costing is also another name for it. That will help us understand things like recoveries from other provinces and what is embedded in our base budgets. And it will help us understand our quality of patient care delivery and efficiency compared to other locales. So an important initiative and building on the science that we will also bring to bear with over time.
And I guess this will be my final question. And it's a fairly long one, but it probably doesn't require a long answer. And we've heard today, and I've heard lots of people say that if you took all the money that you pay nurses to work overtime and just hired more nurses, you could fix a lot of problems. I mean, this is a common, I'm not saying it's the truth, I'm saying it's common perception. But it seems to me, given the unpredictability of healthcare, which we talked about a little while ago, there'll always be the need for a certain amount of overtime, and that the nurses working overtime, I think you've already mentioned, many of them have specialized skills. Can't just pop anybody in there. Can you comment on that just briefly?
Ms. Power, we run out of Ms. time. McNeil? Ms. McNeil?
I think you've almost answered the question for us. So that's exactly the issue, is that as we outlined, a nurse is not a nurse is not a nurse. So because of the specialties, because of the high advanced training and technology in the equipment and the patient population needs, it would be difficult to hire the people who would and provide them with regular full-time work when we really know that we're going to need them in a contingent type of way as on an as-needed basis, either to fill absences or to manage the patient care needs that come up in in an unpredictable or unplanned way. So I think you're absolutely right. There will always be an element of overtime, and some element, I will point to some organizations that have tried, and in fact, we had history many years back of policy where we refused overtime or would say no overtime was allowed, and we know that from a patient care perspective, that's not the right way to go either. There are circumstances where we need to ensure that managers and employees can make decisions in real time that best meet patient needs. Mm-hmm. So there'll always be an element of kind of contingent requirements that come up in the moment. What we are trying to do is ensure that we're using that appropriately and effectively so that we have a sustainable health human resource.
Order. Unfortunately, Ms. Ramey's time has expired. Ms. Regan, and we have 14 minutes in the second round.
Okay, thank you very much. According to the business plan, the district is going to be mitigating about $2 million in cost by maintaining operating rooms at current volume. But we heard earlier today that the number of operations have gone up. So I'm just wondering, will that not lead to increased wait times for surgeries?
Ms. Power?
So, thanks. That's a great question. We have been working with our operating rooms on an efficiency process, and we have this year taken out a significant amount of money, and the plan is next year to continue with that efficiency. We have all of the surgeries that were done this year, the additional surgeries, were done at a cost. When we looked at our overall cost of our operating rooms, we had a reduced cost this year than we did last year. So we are becoming more efficient. We are getting better in terms of our supplies, our contracts that we're having with people. So it's a look at our whole operating process. The intention is certainly not to reduce. We know we've got long waiting lists for many of our surgical procedures. And so we're working hard to, in fact, increase the number of surgeries, but at a reduced costs due to efficiencies, contract negotiations, a number of other initiatives underway.
Similar,
and, Amanda.
Ms. Whitewood.
Thank you. Maybe I can just add to that. So to touch on my earlier comment about case costing, if we look at an area like surgeries where we have growth in volumes and at the same time we've been reducing their budgets, the cost per case has actually come down at the same time. So again, another major point of success for the system, while quality is still maintained. So to give you an idea of that, while the numbers don't seem that significant, they certainly are. So in fiscal 2010, our average inpatient cost would have been our average surgery case cost would have been $2,318. In fiscal 2012, we were looking at $2,234. So if you keep in mind that there's movement in the denominator and numerator, that is a significant shift. So impressive results from our surgery team there.
Now, the mental health budget indicated, we saw before we left the House, that there were going to be $340,000 in costs mitigated within the existing funding envelope to meet new pressures. Will this not increase wait times for mental health?
Ms. Power?
So our mental health programs are working as everybody else is to understand what we need to do to mitigate costs within. Our cost envelope is not increasing. So everybody is facing the same challenges, mental health among them, to understand and to put in place processes to care for the patients who are requiring our needs, but to really start to look at and at the processes that we're currently using. Are they the best? We look to best practice. Is this the best in the country? Are there different ways that we can be doing business? And we have seen some significant changes in our mental health
program as we have in all of our programs. The last thing we want to do is increase waiting lists for any of our patients, but certainly our mental health clients, we know that many of them have very acute needs and immediate needs, and our teams are working hard to be sure that we're addressing those.
Similarly, we have ambulatory care reduction initiatives. I think one of you spoke to that earlier. And the business plan indicates changes will save the district $1 million. Now, I'm wondering, after we had changes last year in the lab test protocol, 18,083 were not performed. So I'm just wondering if what the impact is going to be with the ambulatory care reduction on patients. What are the changes we're talking about?
Ms. Sullivan?
With respect to the ambulatory redesign, I think the work is probably a little bit early to actually comment on the actual impact from a patient care perspective. What I can tell you, though, is every one of the services and programs are currently looking at the patient populations who are actually visiting the ambulatory areas and actually examining whether or not that care is care that is required to be provided at within the Capital Health facilities. Would it be more appropriate care to be either supported or provided in the community and by other healthcare providers at a different level of cost? So I think it's really examining the services we're providing and where best to provide them. In addition to that, looking at the models of care, and we're looking at consolidation of a lot of our ambulatory activities so that in fact, rather than, right, we have at the HI site, for example, work began last year, looking at rather than clinics operating in their little in silos, looking at how you better leverage it from a centralized approach, so from a booking perspective. So rather than each clinic having a booking clerk, for example, you may be able to leverage opportunities by having a centralized approach. So those are the activities we're really looking at.
Thank you, but I think if we're talking about cutting out $1 million from that, it's going to be more than just clerks, you know, having a centralized clerk. There must be some major changes ahead for patients who are in post-surgery, and I'm just we have a lot of different indicators here in the business plan that there are a lot of changes ahead. If we look at laboratory services activity and utilization practice changes, saving the district about $2.3 million. That's another big, huge dollar amount that signals to anybody reading a budget that there are big changes coming. And so I'm wondering, what are the impacts going to be? Once again, do we know for in that particular area how patients are going to be impacted and you know what this is going to mean for them?
Ms. Sullivan?
I think in terms of, just to reiterate, in terms of the patient impact, I think it is too early to actually, I think you're asking for a specific response. I think what we are trying to look at is really looking at where the best place is for those patients to be receiving care and who are the appropriate care providers. I will add one other comment. In ambulatory areas, we also use a lot of supplies, and as we have done in the OR, we will be looking and examining or opportunities for leveraging contract efficiencies as well as supply efficiencies by centralizing as well. And those do offer a lot of opportunities for potential savings.
Ms. Whitewood.
Thank you. In terms of the overall budget for ambulatory care, although it is a distributed model, we know that our annual spend is in excess of $50 million in ambulatory care. So unfortunately, you don't have those numbers in front of you when you're looking at an efficiency of $1 million. So we believe it's feasible. And also in terms of the patient perspective, our person-centered focus, we hear from our patients that there is duplication in our system, and that they don't enjoy that either. So we're working hard to listen to them, to hear their concerns, and to eliminate areas where we do have duplication.
Ms. Power?
So you're asking great questions based on the budget that's in front of you. You don't take out that kind of money from a system when wages are going up and we see changes without there being change. What we have gone into this process, as we have for the last 2 years, is saying the impact on our patients will be the least it can be. And so that is the guiding principle that takes us through every decision that we make. This is about providing safe, appropriate care to our patients. And will patients see a difference? They may. When you look at the lab utilization budget, for instance, what we know is that tests were being ordered on patients over and over and over again that weren't required. And so when we look at that kind of work on utilization, cutting out somebody having blood work done six times when they only needed it once, is not an impact on the patient. And well, in fact, it is. It's a great impact on a patient for the inconvenience of coming. But from a therapeutic perspective or from a treatment perspective, that really wasn't necessary. And it may have been that they went to different doctors. It may have been that the physician treating them thought that that was most appropriate to do. So it's those kinds of initiatives. As Amanda says, there's duplication in the system. We know that. We want to make the experience good for our patients. We want to be sure we're providing safe care. And so, you know, will patients have to wait longer? That's not the intent, and that's not what we're trying to do in all of the work that we're doing. It may happen to some, but that's not how we're moving forward with the work at hand.
Actually, since we did talk about those blood tests, there were 18,000 plus tests that were not done, correct? And some of those did need to be done. Have you worked out a way to figure out if a test is being performed outside what you consider the norm, but the doctor very much feels it needs to be done? Have you worked out a protocol for that now?
So I can't speak to the specific of a protocol for that particular test. What I will say is that our laboratories have been going under the same process that we've been working in our operating rooms around efficiencies to match their targets. We know that we can do things differently and better based on what we see around the country. They've done some amazing work already, but we know there's still room to go. And all of those factors around utilization, which is a big part of the work that's being done in the lab, is being looked at. We want to be there to support physicians in the community and within our healthcare system, and in fact around the province, because we provide service to the whole province. And part of that is around education, educating our family physicians and others about appropriate tests, about changes in testing, because sometimes changes happen around what's the standard testing. So that's all part and parcel of the work that's happening.
There have been rumors floating around that one or more of the blood collection sites is going to close. Is that going to happen?
Is that a blood collection site that Capital Health manages?
That would be the one at Bayers Road or St. Margaret's Bay.
I don't believe that we have any decision around Bears Road for sure. I know that one, but I would say that as I just mentioned to you, that the lab system and the Department of Laboratory Medicine are looking at everything. How do we provide service? Where is the most appropriate place to provide that service? Where is our catchment area? So I don't have the answer to you about St. Margaret's Bay, but I will say that when we look at these kinds of change initiatives, we look at everything that we're doing to be sure that we're doing it as efficiently as possible.
So therefore, are you looking at also at the blood collection site at the VG or the Dartmouth General? Are those in the mix as well?
Always. So everything we do is always in the mix. We are changing continually. We continually look and evaluate the services that we provide. So I don't know the details for you about what the lab is looking at, but we would always track the number of people coming into those various collection areas within our organization. Is that still the most effective and appropriate place to see those patients? So we look at our whole operation on a continual basis.
Ms. McNeil, you only have a couple seconds.
Just wanted to put in, a round change. The lab is a very good area to point to in terms of the technological change. And so the enablement of change in process that things like
order,
technology.
Order, please. Ms. Regan's time has expired. Mr. McMaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question, I noted that in your presentation, I believe about 25% work greater than 25 overtime hours per year. Do any of those people have any, are they part of the decision-making chain for those deciding who gets those hours, or is that completely separate of them?
Ms. McNeil?
The ability, and I may ask Vicky to kind of walk through more detail if it's required, but we adhere to the provisions in the collective agreement around assigning overtime or offering overtime shifts. It's done in a rotational basis to the next most senior on the list. So it doesn't always go back to the top of the list, but where we've left off, we go to the next most senior of the list to make the calls to award the next overtime. Time shift.
Okay. Does the overtime demand come from specialty positions primarily?
When I look at kind of the groups of areas that are most using overtime or have the most use of overtime, it's predominantly from the emergency departments, our critical care areas that include our ICU and our intermediate care units. And then the next one would be our general medicine units. There's been a significant work this year completed in the operating room. The operating room used to have a large use of overtime, but with the efficiency work that's happened there, we've reduced a lot of that.
Okay. So primarily the overtime is, I guess, awarded to, in a sense, some people might not want to be working the extra hours, but I guess it's awarded in the sense that people who get first crack would be based on seniority. Have you ever seen any instances of abuse in the system?
I would say that there's always unintended and, consequences to any process. And one of the things I would say, rather than use the term abuse, there are inconsistent practices. And I think as long as there are decentralized decision-making and people, are deferring to their judgment, oftentimes some people can interpret clauses differently, and that could then be inconsistent, and then others might see that that's a favoritism. Because we've done a lot of work in centralizing that process through the Nursing Resource Office, we're seeing a whole, we've really, I think, got clarity around consistent process and decision-making around overtime.
It sounds like it's being fixed, but is there any repercussions for the inconsistent practices?
We make those changes as we need to go. If there was a real, we always have process around discipline. If there's procedural violations or policy violations, it certainly isn't to that degree that we would see kind of that kind of intent around it. It's more that our managers and others are very busy, and oftentimes we're making these decisions on the fly. Many times there are incidents of patient care needs that are driving that, and we're trying to make the best decision with the information we have at the time. So I think all of the things that we have underway, from the decision-making process in the central staffing office with the technology and real-time data, that'll all lend itself to better decision-making.
And the new information technology that you'll be using will be helpful for the people that are trying to manage that system, too. I can imagine it's very complicated, lots of people involved and lots of chaos. So, I was just looking at some of the information you had provided us with this morning, and I've noticed that there has been a reduction in the number of overtime hours, but the cost for each overtime hour has gone up. Are there any factors outside of those driven by collective bargaining, overtime rates, those kinds of things that would be reason for that increase going up per hour?
Our overtime rates are directly connected or directly attached to the wage rates. So in the last 2 years, the wage rates have been contained at 1% increases year over year. This year, our NSGU nurses were awarded a 5.1% increase over the year. That will adjust that overtime rate this year. So the cost, although the hours may go down, the cost may stay the same or go up.
Do you feel that there's been sort of an inconsistent message from government going from the 1% per year wage increase rate to what we've just seen in that they're trying to ask you to contain the costs of health care, but now with the recent change in wages, that's going to affect your ability to manage the system and continue to contain the cost of the system? Do you find there's a mixed message coming from government there?
I think government is trying to balance the needs of the system, the sustainability of the system in the long term, as well as understanding that we have people who work in this system who are trying to pay bills and keep up with the cost of living, and that's always a balance. The other element that plays into this, and from a health human resource planning perspective, is the ability to recruit and retain people over time, and those have costs as well. So it's not simple in managing this in the long term, and trying to keep all those interests in balance, I think, is challenging.
Okay. Do you feel that we've kind of tried to make light of it in the legislature here about people being thrown under the bus, for instance? Do you feel like you've kind of been put in a position where you're asked to contain costs, but then that power to contain them is taken away from you?
I think we're all being called to leadership in challenging times, and that there are no simple answers anymore. I think if there were simple answers to these problems, then everybody be doing the same thing. I know when we look across the country here in Nova Scotia, we're not much different than many other of our partners in other jurisdictions across the country. We're all, healthcare is the largest expense of the provincial budgets. It's incumbent on us to do what we can to manage those increasing costs. Drug costs, technology costs, and labor costs are big cost drivers. And so as leaders, that's our job, is to look at how can we best manage those to try and flatten the curve of growth that we would see for the long term. And so I believe that's our job to do. So I don't feel that we are being set, that there's any untoward. It's the work that we've been asked to do, and it's the work that we've agreed to do.
Sure. I just sympathize with you, because you can't control the demand of work coming into the system from the people who need the health care, and you can't really control the price of the cost of the labor force, but you're asked to try to live within your means. And I guess sometimes I feel like you're being put in a position where you're asked to do something, but you're not really being given the empowerment to be able to do it. So I sympathize with you there. What was the... recently we had of course, the lead up into the potential strike. What was the general feeling of your medical staff when surgeries and other procedures were being canceled during the ramp down?
Ms. Power?
I will say that this time, probably like no other in my background is nursing, and so I've worked with medical staff for many, many years. I don't think I've ever seen them rise to the occasion that they did. They stepped into a wonderful leadership role in our organization. They understood that this was a process we needed to go through. We needed to bargain in good faith. We have a collective agreement. We were at the table doing that, but we also needed to prepare our organization in the event of a strike for safety, and they stepped into that leadership space in a significant way. There is no question that their work was affected by this, as was everybody's, but I must say it was a proud moment for all of us as they sat around our table and helped us to bring our organization down, and then to help us quickly bring it up in a safe, responsible way.
Thank you. What concessions? There was quite a substantial move from the initial offer made to the final deal that was negotiated. What concessions did your side have to give up in order to secure the best deal for the employees?
So, Kathy, perhaps.
Ms. McNeil.
We went into this round of bargaining with the, I guess, the philosophy or the principle around efficiency. So, again, continuing this work that we've done. So we did bring some proposals to the into bargaining that focused on changes to overtime rates and sick time rates, understanding that those were two particular cost drivers that are currently in the collective agreement. And those are all not unique to Capital Health. They are also cost drivers to other health, employers in the health system in the province. We didn't move on those items. So we've been left with the provisions in the collective agreement. But, you know, it's all part of the process of educating and moving forward. And we're confident that we'll continue to work at creating those efficiencies and looking at how we can manage best within the language of the collective agreement.
Does the wage increase that was offered, does it, and I know that there's always competition for the best healthcare staff to have in the province, but does the increase, does it contribute to the problem where we have other areas of the country comparing themselves to other areas of the country? Once a significant raise is given, that becomes the new high watermark. How do you deal with that?
In Nova Scotia, we have, situated ourselves strategically to be pretty much the middle of the pack. There has been some arbitration decisions in the past that have kind of named us as highest in Atlantic Canada or in the Maritimes. The most recent arbitration for the NSGEU nurses positioned them to be the highest in the Maritimes. Newfoundland is still higher paid. The circumstance for Local 42 was a little different. We knew our nurses were behind when we did the comparative across the country. The group of employees represented by Local 42, it's a varied group, a lot of diversity of positions in that bargaining unit. And they were not in the same situation, so they were, relatively speaking, fairly highly paid in the Maritimes. So that's why I think you see a little bit of a different wage package on the table there. But that's what we try and position ourselves somewhere in the middle of the pack.
Sure. Did the and because the government had been kind of firm in its 1% per year goal in the not too distant past, did they give any reason why they were willing to move away from that?
I think it's part of the bargaining process.
So it's something that's behind closed doors?
It's part of, as Chris mentioned, it is part of the process. We go back, we start at one place and we end up in different places, and it's both the going back and forth.
Sure. But I guess the government chose to leave that 1%. Obviously, that was part of the bargaining process.
As we went into our business planning, that was the amount that we were including in our business plan for mitigation, yes.
Okay. Would you say there are nursing shortages right now?
When we look across the country, I would say that there's no province that's experiencing high levels of shortage or extreme vacancies as we may have seen in the past. That said, though, there's definite needs in every province. As I mentioned here, we have today almost 50 registered nurse positions posted. As Ms. Regan had pointed out, many of them are proactively posted for special care areas. So it's those specialized skills that I think we see that we have a need and are most vulnerable if the people in those areas chose to exercise their retirement options, because there are many in that demographic who are eligible to retire.
What could help to fix that shortage amongst the specialized skills employees?
I think what we're doing is the best we can do. So proactively planning.
Order, please. We run out of time again, unfortunately. Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I am going to try to make my questions very short today because I hope to save some time for Mr. Skibar. How helpful has the Change in Innovation Fund been for the Capital Health?
Ms. Power?
So we're in the planning stages certainly now, but it has, I think it will prove to be extremely helpful for us as we move forward, having the ability to have our scheduling online, understanding the utilization of beds throughout the province will be a huge step forward for us as a province in the healthcare.
Thank you. Capital Health has gone below the national average in relationship to overtime. How does it compare with the other health authorities in Nova Scotia?
Ms. McNeil?
The other health authorities that participate in the HRBN, the benchmarking exercise, have a percentage of overtime rate at 1.5%. So we're a little below the provincial average.
Capital Health has 9 hospitals. Which ones have the most overtime and why?
The two highest use of overtime would be the emergency departments at the Halifax Infirmary and the Dartmouth General. And primarily those are because the emergency department, I think we've spoken to that already this morning, the unpredictability and the stresses that are in the emergency rooms.
We have spent the morning talking about nurses' overtime. Is there a difference between the RN overtime in actual overtime rates and LPNs?
There is higher utilization of overtime by RNs than the LPNs. I'm just going to, I have a note here. The RN, I think, overtime hours per employee is about 32 hours per employee, and overtime for LPN, sorry, per employee is 42. So about 10 hours more in the LPN group.
Thank you. There are a lot of people out there who say that overtime dilemmas here and elsewhere could in fact be minimized by the hiring of more nurses. Now, it's not really that simplistic, is it?
No. The requirement, the contingent nature of overtime is the difficulty. So it's the need to be able to access people with the skills when we need them based on the patient population needs or other needs. So if we were to increase the complement overall, we'd then have another inefficiency in our system. So it's really about balancing efficient and effective use of those human resources and the patient needs and the contingent nature of when we'd need them.
Thank you. We have spent, again, most of the morning talking about overtime, and we haven't, of course, talked about sick leave, and it's been a real concern of mine in health and education for a long time. And I'm wondering if there's any correlation between those that are using a lot of overtime or are being called upon, not using, are being called upon for a lot of overtime. Is there any study that has been done in the amount of sick leave those individuals are actually using? Because somebody that is being overworked, so to speak, may need what they term as mental health days.
Mm-hmm. Back in 2007, we wondered the same thing. So we underwent some research and looked at the group that were working higher numbers of overtime. So I think we've spoken to that 25% number that that are over, and now we have it's gone down to 18% that are over 50 hours per year, and we correlated their experience as individuals of the sick time, and we did not see on an individual level a relationship. So those who worked high overtime did not have higher use of sick leave. However, when we aggregated it and looked at a department or a unit, units that had high level of overtime also had high levels of sick time. So you're absolutely right. There is a relationship at a collective level, but at an individual level, there may not be that same relationship.
Thank you very much. Some remaining time to Mr. Scobar.
Mr. Scobar.
Thank you very much. I've got a couple of my own, but I'm kind of intrigued by that one. So it sounds like you got your chicken, got your egg. Are people taking sick time because they work overtime, or are people getting overtime because people in their unit are sick? It sounds like the latter is more likely.
So this whole issue is a very complex issue. The relationship between overtime and sick time, the numbers of factors that cause people to miss work is complex. Some of the complexities are the fact that it's a shift work, 365 days a year, and predominantly female workforce, very physical workforce. So there are a number of factors that play into sick leave and why people might not be able to attend work. But I think you're right. You're pointing to there could be the use of overtime to fill those absent shifts is a phenomenon that we know to be true.
Now, not to belabor the point, but it was brought up a couple of times that a number of people seem to think that just by hiring more people full-time that would mitigate the need for overtime. And frankly, up until today, I was one of them. So I did learn something today and actually modify my own opinion on that. That being said, you have roughly 3,500 staff, and you're only looking for, did I understand, like 57 postings for more staff, and many of those are anticipatory. That suggests to me an extremely low rate of turnover. Is that the case?
Yeah, our attrition rate for our nursing staff as a collective is around 5.8%, so around 5% attrition, which is not a bad indicator. Some of the attrition rates across the country are closer to 10.
Now, of the attrition, is that people retiring or, Mr. McMaster, I believe, is bringing this up. To what extent are we competing with other jurisdictions, with other areas within the province and other provinces, or I recall a number of years back there was an exodus, at least purported, of our nursing staff to United States. Is that still an issue, or?
Again, multiple factors, but I'll go back to attrition is voluntary separation. So anybody who leaves voluntarily from resignation to retirement, those are the two big groups that would factor into that rate. There are a number of factors that people would influence them to leave. Some of them are workplace related, some of them are personal, some of them are opportunities for advancement. You'll see that oftentimes, and in times like now where we don't have the positions for full-time permanent positions to offer new graduates, many of them go to alternate locations in Canada and in the U.S. to find permanent employment.
And this was touched on as well. So when it does come time for a staffing process, for an initiative come, is there a sufficient pool being trained in Nova Scotia, or do we have access to a sufficient pool to meet the needs of both current and immediate and mid-range future?
Our projections are indicating that yes, there are adequate and numbers of registered nurses being trained and licensed practical nurses being trained. The one area of growth that we see in the acute care sector is in the what we call our care team assistants. There many of them are coming through community colleges as continuing care assistants. The program was set up for the continuing care sector. Through our models of care work, we are developing roles in acute care for the care team assistant, and we know that as a system, that's an area where there's always going to be need as we start to shift the model a little bit and develop more people, have more vacancies in those areas, both in the continuing care sector and in acute care.
I Cumberland North is in Amherst. Basically, Amherst mm-hmm. is the general hospital or the hospital for Cumberland North area. Now, when you're recruiting staff, do you find it easier time? I'm thinking, but maybe not, to recruit staff in rural hospitals? Or do you have any information on that, any data on that?
I'd be speculating, and it'd be anecdotal. We've had experiences, challenges in recruiting some employees to some of our more rural sites. In particular, I'm thinking about Sheet Harbor and some of the work we had. We had to do some innovative things to recruit some registered nurses into the community. In the urban centers, it is a little easier because the schools are located here. The graduates have roots here often. They want to stay. They have friends and family often that they've made relationships. They want to stay in the urban center. There's also relationship with the university, so they have opportunities for continuing education and professional development. So the rural-urban challenges can be complex, and it does mean that one size doesn't fit all in terms of a recruiting strategy. We often have to try different things to recruit to rural sites.
I'm thinking, and even Amherst is one thing, but places like Pugwash or Tanimugosh or Spring Hill would be even more challenging, I'm thinking. So as a consequence, many of the rural areas of, we're moving into the collaborative emergency care model, and I understand from your earlier presentation that the emergency rooms are one of the, obvious reasons, by definition, the most unpredictable of areas where, how much staff you're going to need, how many people are, how many accidents are going to happen on any given day. Is there much or any use of nurse practitioners in your emergency room care or any other model for that matter?
Ms. Power.
So at Capital Health, we've used nurse practitioners in many areas throughout our organization, and in some of our rural sites, we have a nurse practitioner. One of the first, before we ever called it a CEC in this province, had something quite similar to that in Middle Musquodoboit, and in fact, that was held up as a model for the rest of the province, where we have a nurse practitioner working. In our more urban sites, our nurse practitioners tend to be specialists in particular areas like transplant, plantation, dialysis, different things. So we have a significant number of nurse practitioners working throughout. We utilize a paramedic model as well, and have, we're one of the first in the country to do that in our emergency department at the QE2, and looking at that in our other areas. So I think the way that we're approaching it with CEC and with all of the areas where we work is who is the most appropriate person to do the work that our patients require. And nurse practitioners are wonderful assets, and we're thankful that we have so many of them, but there are other care providers as paramedics, advanced care paramedics, and others who I think we need to look to be sure that we've got the right people doing the right work.
Well, I've got 27 seconds, so I'll just like to thank you guys, or thank you for coming to make this presentation. This is one of the ones, many of them I did, but I did learn a few things, and frankly, you were able to change my point of view on a couple of things. Good job, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Order, please. Time for questions has expired. Ms. Power, would you like to make any wrap-up comments?
Well, thank you very much, and thank you to all of you. Your questions were great. We're always thrilled that when we leave, people have been educated and have learned new things about our health system. We hope that we've left with you that we take our stewardship of public funds very seriously. We have been working very hard to be sure that we work within the budget that government has given us, and I think we have a track record to show that. But most importantly for us, it's about delivering safe, quality care, and that's what we're all about at Capital Health. This was a good news story for us, our overtime use, and so hopefully you've heard that through us. We will continue to work on it as we do on every efficiency that's before us. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Comments have been very informative today, and keep up the good work. There was a couple of things asked by Ms. Regan. There was a number of surgeries canceled due to staff shortages that you committed to do, and also the number of nurses working in your system. If you could supply that to the clerk, we'd appreciate it. She'll follow up with a letter anyway, ask some specific things. Next week, we are going to meet at 8:30 in the morning, as we'll be in lockup, and it'll be an in-camera session with the Auditor General. So unless we have any other business, motion to adjourn is in order. By Mr. McKinnon, we stand adjourned. Thank you.